This time on your weekly Constitutional.
I think it would be a mistake to consider impeachment as essentially a legal matter, that impeachment has more traditionally been a political matter because it is embedded in a constitution of checks and balances to create one additional lever for the national legislature to use in the event that a president is conducting himself in a way that is clearly beyond the pale as it relates to his or her constitutional responsibilities.
That was Russell Riley of the University of Virginia's Miller Center, and he tells us that impeachment is not all about our current president, but about Nixon and Clinton and even Andrew Johnson. I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly Constitutional.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law in Knoxville, Tennessee. YWC is underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier.
Well, are you sick of hearing about impeachment like I am and Wayne is and everybody else I speak to is? Well, I understand that. It's an important subject, but it's something we've been hearing an awful lot about lately, and, well, maybe we need a little bit of context. So I called up my old buddy, Russell Riley. He's a professor of presidential studies at a place called the Miller Center at the University of Virginia, an institution that is devoted to studying the presidency, even to making oral history recordings of people from past presidential administrations. Russell knows about as much about the presidency as anybody I know. And so when I called him up recently and said, hey, could you shed a little bit of light on this impeachment thing? He jumped at the chance.
My name is Russell Riley, and I am a professor of presidential studies at the Miller Center at the University of Virginia. And my principal appointment is as the co-chair of the Presidential Oral History Program at the Miller Center, which means that for most of the last 20 years, I've been engaged in collecting confidential oral history interviews with people who've served in high-ranking White House positions, beginning with the Carter administration. So I've worked on every presidency from Jimmy Carter's to now Barack Obama.
Russell, you've been on the show before, and you and I have co-taught at least one seminar at Montpelier, and I've said it before, and I'll say it again, you've got one of the coolest jobs in the world.
I always tell people that I think I have, it's not the kind of job that you anticipate when you start a career or even in doing graduate work on the presidency. But having sort of stumbled back into this at my alma mater, where I got my PhD at the University of Virginia, I always tell people I have one of the world's great jobs, that when doing these oral history interviews with people who have been at critical moments in history and in very important positions, when the interviews are going well, there really is no place in the world you would rather be, that it's just riveting having that opportunity. And so I've always appreciated the job that I have and the few occasions that we've had to work with one another. It's been quite a pleasure. And so when I heard that you might want me to come on and talk today, I'm happy to do it, and I'll do my best.
We're always happy to have you, Russell. Now, you used one word there, though, that might be a bit confusing. You said confidential interview. Surely you don't mean forever.
No. The standard format for this is that we conduct every interview that we record under a veil of confidentiality. The reason is that we don't want the interviewee to edit himself or herself into the tape recorder, that we're trying to create a record that will last for all times of what actually happened within a given White House. And what that means is that with every administration, we'll get into areas that will be a bit uncomfortable or a bit sensitive. And if we were to tell the interviewee that we're going to make use of the interview in 24 hours or in 2 weeks or something like that, they might very well say, I don't think I want to talk about this subject, or I'm going to pull my punches on that subject. We give them the opportunity to tell us when they will allow us to make their interview public. And this follows standard oral history protocols. We don't do anything that's not sort of regular order with respect to oral history. And what that means is that often there will be some significant intervals before the interviews are made public. But it's important for those intervals to pass because it means that people will subsequently feel comfortable letting those interviews go. They're demonstrably this method works because there are often instances in interviews where an interviewee will say, look, I'm going to answer this question now, but I'm going to hold on to this for a while because I don't want it coming out. And then 6 months later, when they get the transcript and have a look at it, they reflect on it. They think, you know, that really wasn't so bad after all. I don't mind this coming out. And it does. And that's just an affirmation that the method works. We've got, you know, interviews, as I said, I've worked on some of the interviews, not the original sessions with the Carter presidency in the early 1980s, but there were interviews during that period where there are still passages that are blacked out because people haven't felt comfortable opening them. But the vast majority of the Carter ones are opened, and we just to provide information to you and your listeners, on November 1, we will be opening the archive on the Bush 43 presidency. That'll be the first occasion that anybody will have to review interviews that we've conducted over the last 10 years or so about the George W. Bush presidency.
Well, I'm sure people are looking forward to that with bated breath. And one of these days, Russell, I'm going to buy you a beer or two or five, and then I'm going to ask you to tell me about Jimmy Carter's secret life, because I'm sure he has one, because nobody can be quite as good as he has been. And by the way, happy 95th birthday today, October the 1st of 2019, Mr. President.
I guess if you're going to live to be 95, you probably do have to have led a pretty exemplary life. I can say that I say this with a reasonable level of certainty that the entirety of President Carter's interview has been made public. So I don't think he has anything in that session that has been held back, if memory serves.
Well,
the interviews would have been with others.
I'm disappointed. I really wanted to get the dirt on him. Okay.
Look, all you got to do is go down to Plains and sit in on a Sunday school class, and I'm sure the confessionals come free and open.
You know, I drove past that church 1,000 times up and down I-75, and I always meant to go down and sit in on one of those, and I didn't, and maybe I should go back.
Maybe so.
Anyway, our subject today is very presidential and very constitutional and very much in the news, and that is, of course, impeachment. Our current president, Donald J. Trump, has suffered a number of, most commentators are saying, a number of very significant setbacks in his attempts to avoid impeachment. And I'm speaking, of course, about the revelations that have occurred in the late summer and early fall of 2019, specifically regarding the conversation he had, a telephone conversation with the president of Ukraine, where the transcript seems to indicate that he was at least soliciting foreign interference in a U.S. election and may have been offering a quid pro quo and may have violated several different statutes, both in those activities and in subsequent efforts to conceal them or withhold information. So as we speak, he's in a pretty tough spot. But before we talked about that, let's put this all in context. Where does this power of impeachment come from?
Well, it's rooted in the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the most important observation that I can make about the impeachment power is that it's best understood as one of the many instances of checks and balances built into the American political system, that although there are, you're a lawyer, Stuart, and you understand the importance of law and legal procedure, that I think it would be a mistake to consider impeachment as essentially a legal matter, that impeachment has more traditionally been a political matter because it is embedded in a constitution of checks and balances to create one additional lever for the national legislature to use in the event that a president is conducting himself in a way that is clearly beyond the pale as it relates to his or her constitutional responsibilities. So although there are many, many legal questions about procedure and about how impeachment will unfold, the most important thing to keep in mind is that the framers of the Constitution considered this a one component of the legislature's power to keep in check a president that otherwise has great powers within our constitutional system. A president is elected once every 4 years, and there was a sense in the debates over the adoption of the Constitution. What are you going to do with somebody who is basically misbehaving in between those intervals? That a four-year term, which was not a given. I mean, they considered both longer and shorter terms, but in a four-year term, what are you going to do if you find a president who is clearly abusing his powers? There needs to be some mechanism within the Constitution that will allow Congress to step in and to punish a president that they believe is not behaving in a constitutional way.
You're so right, Russell. In fact, Alexander Hamilton used very similar language in Federalist 65 when he said this is essentially a political act. And that doesn't mean in the negative way that it's all going to be partisan and we're just going to vote along party lines, even though both he and Madison acknowledged what they called factions in their existence back then. But it's a political act of checking the executive. In fact, it's the ultimate check. Interestingly enough, other federal officials can also be impeached, down to and including federal judges, a number of whom have been impeached and a number of whom have been removed over the last 232 years. So this is an extremely important power of Congress, and it's very, very much within Congress's constitutional powers. And so maybe that's the first modern observation we can make, is that when people say this is unconstitutional or this is a coup of some sort, no, it's very much what the founders anticipated as being necessary.
Yeah, I agree with you entirely. And the other point that I would make as an embellishment on this one is that it is always controversial, because in its very nature, the exercise of the impeachment power, particularly as it relates to the chief executive, is aimed at undermining or reversing a properly constituted election. And that's not something, it's not something that the founders entertained casually. There was significant and what I suspect was heated debate at the time over the desirability of doing this, because there was a great fear that if it was misused, it would undermine the authority of the president. But they understood that there needed to be a sort of check of last resort. And it has certainly been the case that in every instance of impeachment, especially at the presidential level, that it has been highly controversial, partly because of bad associations. I mean, people as old as I am these days will remember Richard Nixon and the agony of Watergate. You know, there was a claim afterwards that our long national nightmare is over. People younger will have had the experience of impeachment with Bill Clinton and all that that entailed, with sordid history of personal misbehavior trotted out, you know, on the front pages of the newspaper. And so there's a bad association with impeachment. But beyond that, the very idea that you can reverse a properly constituted election is not something that anybody ever enters into lightly. So the exercise of impeachment has always been a sort of agonizing reality of American democracy. It's not something that anybody wants to see. I mean, if you look at the polling information today, there's a great division over people. There isn't a huge majority. There's a slight majority in the latest polls that I've looked at in favor of impeachment. But it's never going to be very big, precisely because of the gravity of the situation and precisely because there is such a profound commitment to honoring elections in this country. But I think it's a little bit like chemotherapy. If you were to ask somebody in the abstract, do you want chemotherapy? No. Well, of course not. But under the conditions where a physician calls for it, by all means, you embrace it as an unhappy option, but the best of the options that you have available.
Wow. Impeachment as chemo. That's a pretty stark, but I think a very applicable global comparison. It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. This week, my guest is Russell Riley of the University of Virginia's Miller Center. And guess what? We're talking about impeachment. And now it's time to continue our discussion of impeachment with presidential scholar Russell Riley of the Miller Center at the University of Virginia. Well, there have been two or three impeachments in our history, if you include Richard Nixon, whom we'll get to in a moment. But let's take them in historical order. The first one was Andrew Johnson, right? What can you tell us about that one?
That's correct. Now, there were other impeachments of Supreme Court justices that didn't work. You would know those better than I would. There were discussions of impeachment in earlier eras. John Tyler, for example.
Why did they want to impeach old Tyler?
Well, Tyler was the first vice president to be elevated to the presidency. He was called his accidency by some, and there was a real question.
His accidency. Now that was clever.
His accidency, because he had he acceded to the presidency after Harrison's early death. And so there was a real question at the time about whether the Constitution actually fully vested Tyler with all of the powers of the presidency, or whether he was merely an acting president, a sort of caretaker, and therefore the responsibilities for the executive would sort of convey to the legislature. Tyler didn't believe that, and so he fully asserted that he was president of the United States and as such would fully execute the office, although he had not been elected in the same way that Harrison had. And it occasioned a backlash among members of the cabinet and members of the president's party on Capitol Hill, which, again, neared a course of impeachment, but didn't move in that direction. And there were a couple of other episodes beyond that, but it didn't amount to anything. In other words, you didn't end up, so far as I know, even with an impeachment inquiry. It was just sort of, you know, these ideas were batted around. But
that's very interesting. Before we leave Tyler, you know, that wasn't really resolved constitutionally until 1967, with the 25th Amendment. Which specifically makes it clear that upon the death or disability of the president, the vice president will become president, not an acting president, but actually will have all the powers of the presidency. That was an issue. And scholars and politicians up to 1967 would enter into informal agreements between one another. Presidents and vice presidents would sometimes even execute documents. I'm sure you know about this, where they said, well, interestingly enough, one of them involved Richard Nixon. Eisenhower and he agreed on what would happen if Eisenhower had another and fatal heart attack.
Right.
And so, I mean, there were these workarounds, but it really wasn't resolved until the 25th Amendment. But you're telling me something new. I didn't know that Tyler actually suffered impeachment threats basically because people thought he was being arrogant or he was taking power.
That's exactly right, that there was a sense that he was stepping beyond what the Constitution actually permitted and laying claim to the full powers of the office. And so I think as a practical matter, that had been resolved, and you know, which eventually comes to pass also with Andrew Johnson.
Let's talk about him. By the way, Russell, his house is about 10 miles from here.
Oh, is that right?
Maybe a little further in Greenville, Tennessee. I drove past it 100 times before I finally stopped, and we did a whole episode devoted to specifically to the impeachment of Andrew Johnson. And it's a fascinating trip, and if ever you find yourself anywhere near East Tennessee, I want you to call me, and we'll go and take that tour together.
I will certainly do it, because I'd love to see where this character comes from. He's a very interesting historical character, and I think in many respects, if you're looking for historical antecedents for Donald Trump, then Andrew Johnson may be as close to the guy as you could imagine, because this is somebody whose exercise of the presidency was very unorthodox and in many ways similar to President Trump in that regard, particularly in his open disdain for Congress and his willingness to get out and use what Theodore Roosevelt called the bully pulpit to make extraordinarily pointed critiques of members of Congress. So Johnson accedes to the presidency after the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. And Johnson was from Tennessee, so he was a Southerner. As I recall, was the only loyal Southerner.
Stayed in the Senate, yeah. He was the only senator that stayed in the Senate from a seceding state.
Exactly. But there was a general expectation among the, particularly among the radical members of Congress, who sought to use the aftermath of the Civil War as a way to partly to punish the South, but largely to reinvent Southern political structures in ways that would be more favorable to the black population in the South, that President Johnson would, in fact, go along with this, that in effect, he would continue what they anticipated they would have gotten from Abraham Lincoln. That was not what they got. In effect, what they got was somebody whose Southern sensibilities almost immediately began to reveal themselves. And Johnson very vigorously exercised the powers of the presidency not to carry out a policy of Reconstruction in the South, but basically a policy of restoration in the South. And it was that fundamental conflict that set up the basic contours of an impeachment battle.
And the particular flashpoint was what can only be seen really as an almost punitive law that Congress passed over Johnson's veto, called the Tenure in Office Act, where they essentially said, Mr. President, you can't fire anybody who was in Lincoln's cabinet. And they were particularly thinking of Stanton, the Secretary of War, who was most directly responsible for Reconstruction and the military governments in the South. And so by keeping Stanton there, they were hoping to keep their policies in place rather than Johnson's. And his position was, the president might have to get some of these officials confirmed when he hires them, but there's nothing in the Constitution that says there's any restriction on him firing them. And as president, I get to fire whomever I wish. And by golly, he did it.
And that's exactly right. And in fact, he was exercising only a fraction of the kind of powers that Lincoln had exercised during the Civil War. But the radical members of Congress had tried to create a set of circumstances such that the president would have to go through them in order to set up the governing structures in the Reconstruction South. They established the Tenure of Office Act, which required their approval, and he repeatedly chose to ignore it, and particularly with Stanton, tried to execute a replacement, the Secretary of War being, again, the most powerful figure in the development of Reconstruction in the South. And that was, I think the word that you used was flashpoint. That's a very good and precise word, because the tension had been building between Congress and the president before that flashpoint was reached. And there were a lot of people who were very unhappy with Johnson before then. But this was this was that flashpoint. It was the thing that set everything off. The interesting thing to me, though, about Andrew Johnson's impeachment is that I think that there were 11 or 12 articles, and I don't have it right here in front of me, but there were 11 or 12 articles of impeachment. I think the first 9 or 10 of those related directly to the Tenure of Office Act.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right.
Number 10 basically was a contempt of Congress.
That's the one that always makes me smile, because basically it boils down to, you've said mean things about us.
That's exactly right. I mean, I wish that I had a copy of it here in front of me, because it basically says that the president has with great calumny gone out on the campaign trail and made abusive comments about members of Congress. And there's this very long article with all of these adjectives lined up about the awful nature of Congress and the contempt with which he has treated Congress. And this is, I think, really quite extraordinary, but it's also quite illuminating in that a large part of what Congress was complaining about at the time was not merely the extraordinary exercise of power, but the fact that it was being done against the wishes of what then should have been, sort of the preeminent governing institution. And I think that's actually an important backdrop for understanding not only this impeachment, but some other impeachments, which is a factor in some of my own work that I've been dealing with. I don't think it's coincidental that I'm going to get a little bit ahead of our story here, but I don't think it's coincidental that Andrew Johnson's impeachment occurs immediately after the Civil War, that Richard Nixon's impeachment occurs as the Cold War has boiled over and Vietnam comes to an end, and that Bill Clinton's impeachment comes at the end of the Cold War. And then in each of these instances, I think Congress is primed to try to find a way to reassert their proper role in the constitutional order after a period of time in which the executive, by virtue of the commander-in-chief's responsibilities, has been greatly enlarged. That strikes me as a very different kind of environment than the one that we're in today, where you don't have that sort of common historical background that has been present in every other presidential impeachment. I don't really know what to make of that observation, other than to say I do think it is a very important difference today that we're not coming immediately out of a period in which Congress has clearly felt that it's been in an inferior role with respect to a greatly enlarged presidency.
All right. Well, we still have Nixon and Clinton and Trump to talk about. So let's finish up with Andrew Johnson. He was impeached by a simple majority vote of Congress, which is what the Constitution provides. But he was not removed, was he?
No, he was not. As I recall, he was saved by one vote.
Right. And people typically credit Senator Ross of Kansas. A friend of mine, David O. Stewart, has written a book on Andrew Johnson's impeachment. We talked about that on the show some time ago. And he actually thinks that Ross and maybe others were bribed.
Yeah, I think that there's been a lot. There was even a lot of noise at the time that there were, extraordinary efforts to save the president. But in point of fact, he did survive. One interesting point to make about this is this was occurring, mind you, in the early months of 1868. There had been prior efforts to generated in the House to try to develop an impeachment movement, I think as early as 1866. I don't think as early as 1865, but it did not succeed. In failing, I think it actually had the effect of kind of undermining the idea of impeachment, that because it didn't work, and because there was so much both in the prosecution of impeachment and the defense of it that looked to be sort of low politics, that that impeachment was considered a kind of failed experiment and not something to be taken off the shelf and tried again, except under very, very unusual circumstances. And so it didn't happen for, another 100 years or so?
Yeah, basically so. I mean, Richard Nixon is elected in 1968, which is exactly 100 years from Johnson's impeachment. And then within a few years, he finds himself in hot water. Correct me if I'm wrong, the jury is still out as to whether he approved of or even had prior knowledge of the infamous break-in at the Democratic National Headquarters. But it's very clear, as the subsequent investigation showed, that he participated in a cover-up.
Absolutely. And we know that because we have his own words. One of the great turning points in this episode was the almost accidental discovery of the fact that Richard Nixon had been tape recording his telephone conversations. And I should, as an aside, I should say that one of the other programs here at the Miller Center is the Presidential Recordings Program, which is largely involved in trying to make transcripts of and availability to researchers of those transcripts of Oval Office recordings, which some of which had been done as early as Franklin Roosevelt on a more thorough basis by both John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson, although those tapes were activated by a switch so that the president could say, I want this recorded and throw a switch. Nixon was a technophobe, and so he had a voice-activated system that recorded darn near everything. And although he and his White House absolutely denied that they had anything to do with this, it was said to be a rogue operation, of course, over time. Not only did we discover that the tapes existed, but after a substantial political battle and constitutional battle, the United States Supreme Court, in an 8-0 decision, said that Nixon had to turn those tapes over, that there was no absolute executive prerogative to hold on to those things when Congress had a clear and compelling interest in it.
Yep. Alexander Butterfield was the relatively minor presidential aide who, as you say, casually mentioned in a Watergate hearing that was actually being conducted by former Tennessee Senator Fred Thompson. And people can see this on YouTube. It's very dramatic. Because Thompson asks him, were there recordings there? And there's this long pause where he's very clearly reluctant to say anything. But then he says, yep, they were there. and of course, that was the guy who's sitting behind Butterfield looks very pointedly at someone off camera. And I can just think to myself, that was his gut-churning moment. And of course, from that point forward, everything was about those tapes. Nixon tried to get around actually releasing the tapes themselves by giving edited transcripts, which is another very interesting word these days. And that effort failed. And ultimately, as you say, even though he was asserting executive privilege, the concept that you know, you're not going to reveal the confidential discussions between advisors and the president, the same rationale that you all use with your confidentiality rules. No. Ultimately, the court said no. In this particular circumstance, that privilege don't extend that far. Turn over the tapes. And that's when the infamous smoking gun was discovered.
Right. There was there were discussions which plainly indicated that Nixon was, in fact, involved in the cover-up, notwithstanding his claims to the contrary. There was also an infamous 18-and-a-half-minute gap in a conversation that occurred, I think, within 24 hours after the Watergate break-in. And that tape was erased and, to my knowledge, I guess, never recovered. But the discussion was about what they were going to do about this the fact that the break-in had been uncovered by or interrupted by law enforcement officers. So, but that did not resulted in a protracted battle and an impeachment investigation. It did not end up in an impeachment because Richard Nixon resigned, rather than subject himself to what was, everybody agreed, a fait accompli. There were, at that time, significant numbers of Republicans who had been supportive of Nixon, but who could not, in the face of what the audio recordings told us, could not support the president any longer.
And what really strikes me now is that it was basically a single instance where he said almost casually to shut down the Watergate investigation, to tell
them. That was certainly the smoking gun.
Right.
There were, and I can't remember in real time how many of these things were known and what became known later on as the bulk of these things came out. They had, as you had indicated, they tried to get by with presenting edited transcripts where some of the most condemning information had been removed. But ultimately, that didn't work because the congressional investigators knew that they needed the actual audio tape.
Yep, they sure did. You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. And yeah, we're talking about the same thing that you've been talking about. But have you noticed we're putting it in a little bit of context? We're not just talking about our current president, but about several past presidents and their impeachments or near impeachments. And now it's time to finish my discussion with a good buddy, Russell Riley of the University of Virginia's Miller Center, all about the history and context of impeachment. And hey, before the end of the program, we'll actually talk about what's happening now. Well, I don't want to give too short a shrift to Richard Nixon, but we do have to move on so we can cover everything. He resigns under threat of impeachment, didn't actually get impeached. And then a few years later, Bill Clinton walks on the scene. What happened there?
Well, Clinton, the interesting thing about Clinton's experience is that he was under enormous opposition and duress even before he came into the presidency for his personal indiscretions. I mean, there was a moment during the New Hampshire primary in 1992 where there were tape recordings released conversations with a woman named Jennifer Flowers in from Clinton's time as governor of Arkansas, which seemed to indicate that he was carrying on outside the confines of his marriage. And so between that and some of his personal financial dealings, there had been an enormous amount of investigative energies deployed, not just by Republicans in Congress, but more importantly by talk radio host and journalist, or conservative leaning journalist, to try to go after Clinton. And so what ultimately happened was, and this is a very convoluted set of events, Stuart. How much of this? How much detail do you want me to go into?
Well, we don't have time for all the details, so I think let me see if I can summarize it, and you
it
tell me.
It would take a week, I think.
It really would be, and would involve discussions of cigars and other things that we don't really want to talk about. I will simply say this: that there were multiple investigations. Eventually, allegations surfaced that not only were there other affairs, but there was an affair specifically with a young woman named Monica Lewinsky, who was, I think, 22 years old at the time and was serving as a White House intern. And the president denied those things on television very dismissively and in a way that really sort of threw Lewinsky under the bus.
Right.
And then it emerged that there were certain bodily fluids that were on a dress that Lewinsky had saved. And it was at that moment that the president knew that the jig was up, if you will, and he came clean on this somewhat vague apology on television. I remember watching that.
Right.
And then it, it really, what it really focused on was that during the multiple lawsuits that had been filed, and one of them by a woman named Paula Jones, he had lied under oath during a deposition.
That's correct.
You can't do that. That's a crime.
No. Well, and there were two things going on simultaneously. And I think what the White House tried to do was to sort of drive a wedge between these two things and to make claims in their favor about them. One was a degree of public disgust about the basic facts of the president's behavior and the fact that he was carrying on with a young woman who was not much older than his daughter. And then there was the lying and the cover-up of that behavior. And the impeachment effort largely focused on the latter, although the predicate behavior was undeniably a core part of what they were after. I mean, particularly if you go back and read things that Kenneth Starr, who was the independent counsel investigating at the time, he clearly was repulsed by the president's personal behavior. And I think that was a large part of the motive force that moved them towards impeachment. But the more formal part of the impeachment related to lying under oath. And so he was impeached by the House of Representatives. Strangely, this occurred, as I recall, just before the 1998 midterm elections. It was certainly very proximate to the 1998 midterm election. Mm-hmm. Normally, in second-term midterm elections, presidents lose huge numbers of their partisans. And in this case, I think the Democrats picked up a few seats, which was a phenomenal performance. And had the effect of kind of inoculating the president, because everybody in Washington could understand what that meant, which was the American people, however much repulsed they may have been by the president's individual behavior, did not believe that this rose to an impeachable offense that would have led to the removal of this president. And so he easily survived the vote in the Senate over whether he would be removed from.
Yeah, the argument was this has nothing to do with his being president. It's reprehensible behavior. But let's be honest, you know, other presidents, you know, notably John Kennedy, right, have done similar things. They didn't get impeached. He shouldn't be impeached. And moreover, you Republicans are just doing this to be rid of an opponent. And indeed, it comes out later that many of the leaders of the impeachment attempt were apparently carrying on affairs themselves
exactly
at the time.
Exactly.
And I think most people realize that. Most people, you know, I think something like 50% of marriages or plus break up, and a number of people, significant percentages of married people, admit in research that they have been unfaithful, and most of them, if caught, would probably lie.
Right.
I mean, it's not to defend any of that behavior, but it's very much within the realm of normal human behavior, and I think most people recognize that.
Well, I agree with you. I think that if you go back and look at what the polling was saying at the time, and you look at the performance in Washington, there was a general sense that far too much was being made of this, that it was a constitutionally suspect reaction to what was, everybody agreed was inappropriate behavior, but didn't rise to the level of an impeachable offense, and he survived it. Whereas the leaders of the House of Representatives, the Republican leadership, Bob Livingston and Newt Gingrich, both were basically run out of office because of the same offenses.
Yep,
they had to confess that they too had carried on outside the confines of their marriages.
My goodness. All right. If we learn anything, then you shouldn't be impeached for having affairs. That brings us up to the present day, to 2019, where we started. And our current president now finds himself on the wrong end of a formal impeachment inquiry. What are the parallels between, what do we learn from history? What lessons are there to be applied in this particular circumstance with Donald Trump?
Well, I think one thing I would say is that all of these instances are iterative. That, in other words, impeachment doesn't just break out from nowhere. That in every case, there's been a pattern of behavior that has led to pushback from Congress. Concerns about misbehavior within the executive branch, and then ultimately people get to the point where they feel like it has crossed a line that where the president's behavior is no longer tolerable. So, you know, there have been these discussions going on in Washington right now. Should the House investigation just focus on the Ukraine matter, or should we go back and try to dredge up some of the things like from the Mueller report? As though you could forget all of that history when you come to consider the question of impeachment over Ukraine. And I think one of the things that we learn from history is that that the relevant behavior of a president is always in the mind of Congress as they contemplate. So you don't just forget what's gone before, but that's not that's not unusual.
Yeah, and these allegations, unlike the Clinton allegations, go to official conduct. I mean, they're not threatening to impeach Trump because of business dealings or things he did in his past, or even for his rather.
No, well, Stuart, I think you put your finger on something uh-huh. that's very important, and that takes us back to the discussions of the framers, who were particularly concerned about the conduct of foreign policy and mm-hmm. the possibility that a president could be undermining the national security of the United States of America in favor of his own personal benefit. That was something that James Madison and Alexander Hamilton and others had very much in mind when they were discussing the inclusion of an impeachment mechanism. And therefore, that makes this particular punishment especially apt in this instance, in a way that it certainly was not in the case of the Clinton impeachment. Arguably was with Nixon, but not with not with Clinton.
Of those three preceding impeachment procedures, Clinton, Nixon, and Johnson, which of the three do you think is the closest to the one we've got now? Which has the greatest parallel with what we're seeing with Trump?
No, I actually think it's Andrew Johnson.
Not Nixon. Everybody's comparing him to Nixon all the time, but you think it's Johnson. How come?
I say Johnson because I think that a large part of the criticism of Donald Trump is of his violation of the political norms that have long governed behavior in Washington. Now, he openly came into office as a wrecking ball, saying that he was going to, knock down a lot of. He was basically going to knock the walls down around the swamp. Right? We're going to drain the swamp. If you're going to drain the swamp, you're going to have to figure out a way to knock those walls down to let stuff drain out. As a piece of that, however, although there were those who believed that President Trump would operate within certain agreeable confines of the presidency, he has shown no interest in staying within confines, so that there seems to be no, we use the term guardrails to use a different metaphor. There seem to be no guardrails out there that are quite strong enough to hold him in. And so I think that's where the Johnson impeachment is most apt, that the great concern among members of Congress at the time was that this was a president who did not understand the proper functioning of the American political system, did not properly agree to the role of an independent Congress as a part of the American constitutional structure, and therefore felt it necessary to push back because the president wasn't honoring the constitutional confines that the founders had created. And so that's why I think Johnson, and it's also partly personality driven, that I think Johnson, very much like Trump, was somebody who was prone to crude uses of language, who had a bit of what we sort of conventionally consider narcissism, although I haven't done any direct observations, but
you can just put it this way, Russell. Haters gotta hate.
Okay.
And both of these guys are world-class haters. I'm also struck by the fact that the pardons were what got Johnson in trouble. And Trump's been handing out pardons, too, for reasons that many people look askance at.
Yeah, I think you're right. But, the other piece of this is that there is a sort of lack of appreciation for what the constitutional barriers are intended to do, and I think this is in the current instance. This is I think one of the most complicated aspects of this problem. I've spent basically the last 20 years in very close contact with Democrats and Republicans, talking with them about presidential behavior on a candid and confidential basis. And so this transcript of the conversation with the president of Ukraine is posted online, and I look at it. And my first reaction is there is no alternative other than impeachment for this kind of behavior, that raising these kinds of domestic political issues in a conversation with a foreign leader, where you, on the plain reading of the transcript, are seeking to discredit a political opponent, that is an extraordinary violation of what we typically, those of us who professionally follow the presidency, know to understand and expect from a president in a conversation with a foreign head of state. The problem that the president's critics have is that the vast majority of the American people don't follow these things. They don't understand the diplomatic particulars. They don't know where Ukraine is. They don't understand the relationship of Ukraine and Russia and the the extraordinary importance of good American-Ukrainian relations as a check against the Russians in that region. And so all of these things that are easily understandable for people who follow the president professionally are not easily understandable to the vast majority of the American people, and that is the great challenge for those who are seeking impeachment at this time, because it is so easy for the president's defenders at this point to say it's much ado about nothing, right? That it's just a phone call. That even the Ukrainian president said he wasn't pressuring me, which is quite a quite beside the point. This I think is the real problem that the president's opposition will have right now, is that they have to find a way to communicate to the American people why these diplomatic niceties matter and why this was such a profound violation, so profound as to actually undermine the national security of the United States.
Well, Russell Riley, education is why we do this show, and we never do it better than when you are on it. So thank you very, very much for speaking with us today.
Well, I'm happy to talk with you. And again, I'm occasionally there was some fuzziness prevailed in my memory on some of these particulars, but because I'm in the company of an extraordinary mind in the host of this program, you saved me on a couple of occasions, and I appreciate it.
We saved one another, Russell. Thank you again.
Terrific to talk with you. Thanks, Stuart.
Before the National Trust for Historic Preservation acquired the Montpelier Estate, it was owned by Marion DuPont Scott, a trailblazer of social change in the early 20th century. As a child, the tomboyish Marion DuPont played outdoors and rode horseback. She established the annual horse racing event known as the Montpelier Hunt Races, an event held to this day at the Montpelier Estate. DuPont was married twice, first to Inspector Thomas Somerville for 10 years before divorcing, then to Virginia-born Hollywood actor Randolph Scott, who was best man at her first wedding. She and Scott divorced after 3 years, and DuPont never married again. She never had any children from either marriage. Because of this, her father William bequeathed the estate to his brother and nephews. Marion had other ideas. Her will included a provision that allowed her cousins to sell their assets to the National Trust in exchange for a share of the family trust. This is Tyler Stanley with the Madison Minute.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Russell Riley of the University of Virginia's Miller Center, who's told us all about impeachment through the ages and maybe in the future. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check them out on Spotify. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.